future based on some past experience. If you recall, the Newtonian model of reality is all about predicting an outcome. Now we are trying to control our reality instead of surrendering to something greater. All we're doing is trying to survive. If the quantum model of reality ultimately defines everything as energy, why do we experience ourselves more as physical beings than as beings of energy? We could say that the survival-orientated emotions are energy in motion, are lower frequency or lower energy emotions. They vibrate at a slower wavelength, and therefore ground us into being physical. We become denser, heavier, and more corporeal because that energy causes us to vibrate more slowly. The body quite literally becomes composed of more mass and less energy. More matter, less mind. Refer to Figure 5A, Survival Emotions versus Elevated Emotions. So it might make sense that if we inhibit our more primitive survival emotions and begin to break our addiction to them, our energy will be higher in frequency and less likely to root us to the body. In a way, we can liberate energy from the body when the body has become the mind into the quantum field. As our emotions become more elevated, we will naturally ascend to a higher level of consciousness, closer to source, and feel more connected to universal intelligence. When the stress response is turned on, whether in response to a real or conjured up threat, a powerful cascade of chemicals rushes into our system and gives us a strong jolt of energy, momentarily waking up our bodies and certain parts of the brain to put all of our attention on the big three. This is very addictive to us because it's like drinking a triple espresso. We get turned on for a few moments. In time, we unconsciously become addicted to our problems, our unfavorable circumstances, our unhealthy relationships. We keep these situations in our lives to feed our addiction to survival-orientated emotions, so that we can remember who we think we are as a somebody. We just love the rush of energy we get from our troubles. Moreover, we also associate this emotional high with every person, thing, place, and experience in our outer world that is known and familiar. We become addicted to these elements in our environment as well. We embrace our environment as our identity. If you agree that we can turn on the stress response just by thinking, then it stands to reason that we can get the same rush of addictive stress chemicals as if we were being chased by a predator. As a consequence, we become addicted to our very thoughts. They begin to give us an unconscious adrenaline high, and we find it very hard to think differently. To think greater than how we feel, or to think outside of the proverbial box, becomes just too uncomfortable. The moment we begin to deny ourselves the substance we're addicted to, in this case the familiar thoughts and feelings associated with our emotional addiction, there are cravings, withdrawal pains, and a host of inner sub-vocalizations, urging us not to change. And so we remain chained to our familiar reality. Thus our thoughts and feelings, which are predominantly self-limiting, hook us back to all the problems, conditions, stresses, and bad choices that produce the fight or flight effect in the first place. We keep all these negative stimuli around us so that we can produce the stress response, because that addiction reinforces the idea of who we are, only serving to reaffirm our own personal identity. Simply put, most of us are addicted to the problems and conditions of our lives that produce stress. No matter whether we're in a bad job or a bad relationship, we hold our troubles close to us because they help reinforce who we are as a somebody. They feed our addictions to lower frequency emotions. Most harmful of all, We live in fear that if those problems were taken away, we wouldn't know what to think, how to feel, and we wouldn't get to experience the rush of energy that causes us to remember who we are. For most of us, God forbid we not be a somebody. How awful would it be to be a nobody, to not have an identity? As you can see, what we identify as ourself exists within the context of our collective emotional association with our thoughts and feelings, our problems and all those elements of the big three. Is it any wonder that people find it so hard to go within and leave this self-produced reality behind? How would we know who we are if it weren't for our environment, our bodies and time? That's why we are so dependent upon the external world. We limit ourselves to using our senses to define and cultivate emotions, so that we can receive the physiological feedback that reaffirms our own personal addictions. We do all this to feel human. When our survival response is way out of proportion to what is happening in our outer world, that excess of stress response hormones causes us to become fixated within the parameters of self. So, we become overly selfish. We obsess about our bodies or a particular aspect of our environment, and we live enslaved to time. We're trapped in this particular reality, and we feel powerless to change, to break the habit of being ourselves. These excessive survival emotions tip the scales of a healthy ego, the self we consciously refer to when we say I. When the ego is in check, its natural job is to make sure we are protected and safe in the outer world. As an example, the ego makes sure we stay far away from a bonfire or a few steps away from the cliff's edge. When the ego is balanced, its natural instinct is self-preservation. There's a healthy balance between its needs and those of others, its attention to itself and to others. When we're in survival mode in an emergency situation, it makes sense that the self should take priority. But when chronic long-term stress chemicals push the body and brain out of balance, the ego becomes over-focused on survival and puts the self first to the exclusion of anything else. We're selfish all the time. Thus, we become self-indulgent, self-centered and self-important, full of self-pity and self-loathing. When the ego is under constant stress, it's got a me-first priority. Under those circumstances, the ego is primarily concerned with predicting every outcome of every situation, because it is overly focused on the outer world and feels completely separated from the 99.99999% of reality. In fact, the more we define reality through our senses, the more this reality becomes our law. And material reality as law is the very opposite of the quantum law. Whatever we place our awareness on is our reality. Consequently, if our attention is focused on the body and our physical realm, and if we become locked into a particular line of linear time, then this becomes our reality. To forget about the people we know, the problems we have, the things we own and the places we go, to lose track of time, to go beyond the body and its need to feed its habituations, to give up the high from emotionally familiar experiences that reaffirm the identity, to detach from trying to predict a future condition or review a past memory, to lay down the selfish ego that is only concerned with its needs, to think or dream greater than how we feel and crave the unknown. This is the beginning of freedom from our present lives. Let's go one step further. I explained earlier that we can turn on the stress response by thought alone. I also mentioned the scientific fact that the chemicals associated with stress pull the genetic trigger by creating a very harsh environment outside of ourselves, and thus creating disease. So, by pure reason, our thoughts can actually make us sick. If our thoughts can make us sick, might they also make us well? Let's say that a person has had some experiences within a short time frame that caused him to feel resentful. As a result of his unconscious reactions to those occurrences, he held on to his bitterness. Chemicals corresponding to this emotion flooded his cells. Over weeks, his emotion turned into a mood, which continued for months and changed into a temperament, which was sustained for years and formed a strong personality trait called resentment. In fact, he memorized this emotion so well that the body knew resentment better than the conscious mind, because he remained in a cycle of thinking and feeling and thinking, that way for years. Based on what you learned about emotions as being the chemical signature of an experience, wouldn't you agree that as long as this person clings to resentment, his body will react as though it is still experiencing the long-ago events that first caused him to embrace this emotion? Moreover, if the body's reaction to those chemicals of resentment disrupted the functions of certain genes, and this sustained reaction kept signaling the same genes to respond in the same way, might the body eventually develop a physical condition, such as cancer? If so, is it possible that once he unmemorized the emotion of continuous resentment, by no longer thinking the thoughts that created the feelings of resentment, and vice versa, his body, as the unconscious mind, would be free from that emotional enslavement? In time, would he stop signaling the genes the same way? And finally, let's say he began thinking and feeling in new ways, to such a degree that he invented a new ideal for himself, related to a new personality. As he moved into a new state of being, might he signal his genes in beneficial ways and condition the body into an elevated emotional state, ahead of the actual experience of good health? Could he do this to the extent that the body would begin to change by thought alone? What I just described in simple terms happened to a student in one of my seminars who overcame cancer. Bill, 57, was a roofing contractor. A lesion had appeared on his face and a dermatologist diagnosed malignant melanoma. Although Bill underwent surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy, the cancer recurred in his neck, then his side, and finally his calf. Each time he underwent a similar course of treatment. Naturally, Bill experienced why me moments. He understood that his excessive sun exposure was a risk factor, but he knew others who had been similarly exposed and didn't develop cancer. He fixated on that unfairness. After treatment for the same cancer on his left flank, Bill pondered whether his own thoughts, emotions, and behaviors had contributed to his condition. In a moment of self-reflection, he realized that for more than 30 years, he had been stuck in resentment, thinking and feeling that he always had to give up what he wanted for the sake of others. For example, he had wanted to become a professional musician after high school, but when an injury left his father unable to work, Bill had to join his family's roofing company. He habitually re-experienced his feelings upon being told he had to give up his aspirations, to the extent that his body still lived in that past. This also set up a pattern of dreams deferred. Whenever something didn't go his way, such as the housing market collapsing just after he expanded the business, he always found someone or something to blame. Bill had so memorized the emotional response pattern of bitterness that it dominated his personality and became an unconscious program. His state of being had signaled the same genes for so long that they had created the disease that now afflicted him. No longer could Bill allow his environment to control him. The people, places, and influences in his life had always dictated how he thought, felt, and behaved. He sensed that to break the bonds with his old self and reinvent a new one, he would have to leave his familiar environment. So for 2 weeks in Baja, Mexico, he retreated from his familiar life. The first 5 mornings, Bill contemplated how he thought when he felt resentment. He became a quantum observer of his thoughts and feelings. He became conscious of his unconscious mind. Next, he paid attention to his previously unconscious behaviors and actions. He decided to halt any thought, behavior, or emotion that was unloving towards himself. After the first week of this vigilance, Bill felt free because he had liberated his body from its emotional addiction to resentment. By inhibiting the familiar thoughts and feelings that had driven his behaviors, in a sense, he impeded the signals of the survival emotions from conditioning his body to the same mind. His body then released energy, which was available to use to design a new destiny for himself. For the next week, Bill became so uplifted that he thought about the new self he wanted to be and how he would respond to the people, places, and influences that previously controlled him. For instance, he decided that whenever his wife and kids expressed a wish or need, he would respond with kindness and generosity instead of making them feel like a burden. In short, he focused on how he wanted to think, act, and feel when presented with situations that had challenged him in the past. He was creating a new personality, a new mind, and a new state of being. Bill began to put into practice what he'd placed in his mind while sitting on that Baja beach. Shortly after his return, he noticed that the tumor on his calf had fallen off. In a week or so, when he went to his doctor, he was cancer-free. He has remained that way. By firing his brain in new ways, Bill changed biologically and chemically from his previous self. As a result, he signaled new genes in new ways, and those cancer cells couldn't coexist with his new mind, new internal chemistry, and new self. Once trapped by the emotions of the past, he now lives in a new future. At the end of the previous chapter, I briefly described what it is like to live in creative mode. Those are the moments of being fully engaged and in flow so that the environment, the body, and time all seem immaterial and don't invade our conscious thoughts. Living in creation is living as a nobody. Ever notice that when you're truly in the midst of creating anything, you forget about yourself. You disassociate from your known world. You are no longer a somebody who associates your identity with certain things you own, particular people you know, certain tasks you do, and different places you lived at specific times. You could say that when you are in a creative state, you forget about the habit of being you. You lay down your selfish ego and become selfless. You have moved beyond space and time and become pure, immaterial awareness. Once you're no longer connected to a body, no longer focused on people, places, or things in your external environment, and beyond linear time, you're entering the door of the quantum field. You cannot enter as a somebody. You must do so as a nobody. You have to leave the self-centered ego at the door and enter the realm of consciousness as pure consciousness. And as I said in Chapter 1, in order to change your body to foster better health, something in your external circumstances, a new job or relationship perhaps, or your timeline toward a possible future reality, you have to become no body, no thing, no time. Thus here is the grand hint. To change any aspect of your life, body, environment, or time, you must transcend it. You must leave behind the big three in order to control the big three. When we are in creation, we are activating the brain's creative center, the frontal lobe, part of the forebrain and comprising the prefrontal cortex. This is the newest, most evolved part of our human nervous system and the most adaptable part of the brain. It tends to be the creative center of who we are and the brain's CEO or decision-making apparatus. The frontal lobe is the seat of our attention, focus, concentration, awareness, observation, and consciousness. It is where we speculate on possibilities, demonstrate firm intention, make conscious decisions, control impulsive and emotional behaviors, and learn new things. For the sake of our understanding, the frontal lobe performs three essential functions. These will all come into play as you learn and practice the how-to meditative steps for breaking the habit of being yourself in part 3 of this book. Number 1. Metacognition, becoming self-aware to inhibit unwanted states of mind and body. If you want to create a new self, you first have to stop being the old self. In the process of creation, the first function of the frontal lobe is to become self-aware. Because we have metacognitive capabilities, the power to observe our own thoughts and self, we can decide how we no longer want to be, to think, act, and feel. This ability to self-reflect allows us to scrutinize ourselves and then make a plan to modify our behaviors, so that we can produce more enlightened or desirable outcomes. Your attention is where you place your energy. To use attention to empower your life, you will have to examine what you've already created. This is where you begin to know thyself. You can look at your beliefs about life, yourself, and others. You are what you are where you are, and you are who you are because of what you believe about yourself. Your beliefs are the thoughts you keep consciously or unconsciously accepting as the law in your life. Whether you are aware of them or not, they still affect your reality. So if you truly want a new personal reality, start observing all aspects of your present personality. Since they primarily operate below the level of conscious awareness, much like automatic software programs, you will have to go within and look at these elements you probably haven't been aware of before. Given that your personality comprises how you think, act, and feel, you must pay attention to your unconscious thoughts, reflexive behaviors, and automatic emotional reactions. Put them under observation to determine if they are true and whether you want to continue to endorse them with your energy. To become familiar with your unconscious states of mind and body takes an act of will, intention, and heightened awareness. If you become more aware, you will become more attentive. If you become more attentive, you will become more conscious. If you grow to be more conscious, you will notice more. If you notice more, you will have a greater ability to observe self and others, both inner and outer elements of your reality. Ultimately, the more you observe, the more you awaken from the state of the unconscious mind into conscious awareness. The purpose of becoming self-aware is so that you no longer allow any thought, action, or emotion you don't want to experience to pass by your awareness. Thus, in time, your ability to consciously inhibit those states of being will stop the same firing and wiring of the old neural networks that are related to the old personality. And as a result of no longer recreating the same mind on a daily basis, you prune away the hardware that is related to the old self. In addition, by interrupting the feelings that are associated with those thoughts, you are no longer signaling genes in the same way. You are stopping the body from reaffirming itself as the same mind. This process is whereby you quite simply begin to lose your mind. So as you develop the skill of becoming familiar with all aspects of your old self, you will ultimately become more conscious. Your goal here is to unlearn who you used to be so that you can free up energy to create a new life, a new personality. You can't create a new personal reality as the same personality. You have to become someone else. Metacognition is your first task in moving from your past to creating a new future. 2. Creating a new mind to think about new ways of being. The second function of the frontal lobe is to create a new mind, to break out of the neural networks produced by the ways that your brain has been firing for years on end, and influence it to rewire in new ways. When we set aside time and private space to think about a new way of being, that is when the frontal lobe engages in creation. We can imagine fresh possibilities and ask ourselves important questions about what we really want, how and who we want to be, and what we want to change about ourselves and our circumstances. Because the frontal lobe has connections to all other parts of the brain, it is able to scan across all the neural circuits to seamlessly piece together stored bits of information in the form of networks of knowledge and experience. Then it picks and chooses among those neural circuits, combining them in a variety of ways to create a new mind. In doing that, it creates a model or internal representation that we see as a picture of our intended result. It makes sense, then, that the more knowledge we have, the greater the variety of neural networks we've wired, and the more capable we are of dreaming of more complex and detailed models. To initiate this step of creation, it's always good to move into a state of wonder, contemplation, possibility, reflection, or speculation by asking yourself some important questions. Open-ended inquiries are the most provocative approach to producing a fluent stream of consciousness. What would it be like to? What is a better way to be? What if I was this person living in this reality? Who in history do I admire, and what were his, her admirable traits? The answers that come will naturally form a new mind, because as you sincerely respond to them, your brain will begin to work in new ways. By beginning to mentally rehearse new ways of being, you start rewiring yourself neurologically to a new mind. And the more you can remind yourself, the more you'll change your brain and your life. Whether you want to be wealthy, or a better parent, or a great wizard for that matter, it might not be a bad idea to fill your brain with knowledge on your chosen subject, so that you have more building blocks to make a new model of reality you want to embrace. Every time you acquire information, you're adding new synaptic connections that will serve as the raw materials to break the pattern of your brain firing the same way. The more you learn, the more ammo you have to unseat the old personality. Refer figure 5b, the frontal lobe as creator. 3. Making thought more real than anything else. During the creative process, the frontal lobe's third vital role is to make thought more real than anything else. Stay tuned for how to in part 3. When we're in a creative state, the frontal lobe becomes highly activated and lowers the volume on the circuits in the rest of the brain, so that little else is being processed but a single-minded thought. Since the frontal lobe is the executive that mediates the rest of the brain, it can monitor all of the geography. So it lowers the volume on the sensory centers, responsible for feeling the body, motor sensors, responsible for moving the body, association centers, where our identity exists, and the circuits that process time, in order to quiet them all down. With very little neural activity, we could say that there is no mind to process sensory input. Remember that the mind is the brain in action. No mind to activate movement within the environment, and no mind to associate activities with time. Then we have no body. We have become no thing. We are no time. We are in that moment pure consciousness. With the noise shut off in those areas of the brain, the state of creativity is one in which there is no ego or self as we have known it. When you are in creation mode, the frontal lobe is in control. It becomes so engaged that your thoughts become your reality and your experience. Whatever you're thinking about in those moments is all there is for the frontal lobe to process. As it lowers the volume from other areas of the brain, it shuts out distractions. The inner world of thought becomes as real as the outer world of reality. Your thoughts are captured neurologically and branded into your brain's architecture as an experience. If you effectively execute the creative process, this experience produces an emotion, as you know, and you begin to feel like that event is actually happening to you in the present. You are one with the thoughts and feelings associated with your desired reality. You are now in a new state of being. You could say that in that moment, you are now rewriting the subconscious programs by reconditioning the body to a new mind. Refer figure 5C, the frontal lobe as the volume control. In the act of creation, when we become that no body or no thing in no time, we no longer create our customary chemical signature, because we are not the same identity. We don't think and feel in the same way. Those neural networks our survival thinking had wired are turned off, and the personality that was addicted to continually signaling the body to produce stress hormones is gone. In short, the emotional self that lived in survival mode is no longer functioning. The moment that happens, our former identity, the state of being bound by survival-based thinking and feeling, is no more. Since we are no longer being the same being, emotional energy that had been bound to the body is now free to move. So where does the energy go that once fed that emotional self? It has to go somewhere, so it moves to a new place. That energy, in the form of emotion, moves up the body from the hormonal centers to the heart area, on its way up to the brain. And all of a sudden we feel great. Joyful, expanded. We fall in love with our creation. That's when we experience our natural state of being. Once we stop energizing that emotional self, powered by the stress response, we have moved from being selfish to selfless. With that old energy transmuted into a higher frequency emotion, the body is liberated from its emotional bondage. We are lifted above the horizon to behold a whole new landscape. No longer perceiving reality through the lenses of those past survival emotions, we see new possibilities. We are now quantum observers of a new destiny, and that release heals the body and frees the mind. Let's revisit the chart of energy and frequencies from the survival emotions to the elevated emotions. See figure 5A. When anger or shame or lust are released from the body, they will be transmuted into joy, love, or gratitude. On this journey to broadcasting higher energy, the body, which we condition to be the mind, becomes less of the mind and becomes more coherent energy. The matter that makes up the body expresses a higher vibratory rate, and we feel more connected to something greater. In short, we are demonstrating more of our divine nature. When you're living in survival, you're trying to control or force an outcome. That's what the ego does. When you're living in the elevated emotion of creation, You feel so lifted that you would never try to analyze how or when a chosen destiny will arrive. You trust that it will happen because you have already experienced it in mind and body, in thought and feeling. You know that it will because you feel connected to something greater. You are in a state of gratitude because you feel like it's already happened. You may not know all the specifics of your desired outcome, when it will take place, where, and under what circumstances, but you trust in a future that you can't see or otherwise perceive with your senses. To you, it has already occurred in no space, no time, no place, from which all things material spring forth. You are in a state of knowingness. You can relax into the present and no longer live in survival. To anticipate or analyze when, where, or how the event will occur would only cause you to return to your old identity. You are in such joy that it's impossible to try and figure it out. That's only what human beings do when they are living in limited states of survival. As you linger in this creative state where you are no longer your identity, the nerve cells that once fired together to form that old self are no longer wiring together. That's when the old personality is being biologically dismantled. Those feelings connected to that identity, which conditioned the body to the same mind, are no longer signaling the same genes in the same ways. And the more you overcome your ego, the more the physical evidence of the old personality is changed. The old you is gone. Refer figure 5D, the two states of the mind and body. By completing part one of this book, you have intentionally acquired a knowledge base that will help you create your new self. Now, let's build on that base. We've covered a lot of possibilities. The concept that your subjective mind can affect your objective world. Your potential to change your brain and body by becoming greater than your environment, your body and time. And the prospect that you can move out of the reactive, stressful mode of living in survival, as though only the outer world is real, and enter the inner world of the Creator. It is my hope that you can now view these possibilities as possible realities. If you can, then I invite you to continue on to part two, where you will gain specific information about the role of your brain and the meditative process that will prepare you to create real and lasting changes in your life. Part 2. Your Brain and Meditation. Chapter 6. Three Brains. Thinking, to Doing, to Being. It's often useful to compare one's brain to a computer, and it's true that yours already has all the hardware you'll need to change yourself and your life. But do you know how best to use that hardware to install new software? Picture two computers with identical hardware and software, one in the hands of a tech novice and the other being used by an experienced computer operator. The beginner knows little about what kinds of things a computer can do, let alone how to do them. The intention behind part two, simply put, is to provide pertinent information about the brain, so that when you, as its operator, begin to use the meditative process to change your life, you will know what needs to happen in your brain and in your meditations and why. If you know how to drive a car, then you've already experienced probably the most elementary example of thinking, doing, and being. At first, you had to think about every action you took and about all those rules of the road. Later, you became fairly proficient at driving, as long as you paid conscious attention to what you were doing. Eventually, you were being a driver. Your conscious mind slid over and became a passenger. And ever since, your subconscious mind has probably occupied the driver's seat most of the time. Driving has become automatic and second nature to you. Much of what you learn is via this progression from thinking to doing to being. And three areas of the brain facilitate this mode of learning. But did you know that you can go directly from thinking to being? And it's likely that you have already experienced this in your life. Through the meditation that is at the heart of this book, this chapter will give you a prelude, you can go from thinking about the ideal self you want to become straight to being that new self. That is the key to quantum creating. Change all begins with thinking. We can immediately form new neurological connections and circuits that reflect our new thoughts. And nothing gets the brain more excited than when it's learning, assimilating knowledge and experiences. These are aphrodisiacs for the brain. It fondles every signal it receives from our five senses. Every second it processes billions of bits of data. It analyzes, examines, identifies, extrapolates, classifies, and files information, which it can retrieve for us on an as-needed basis. Truly, the human brain is this planet's ultimate supercomputer. As you recall, the basis for understanding how you can actually change your mind is the concept of hardwiring, how neurons engage in long-term habitual relationships. I've talked about Hebbian learning, which states, nerve cells that fire together, wire together. Neuroscientists used to think that after childhood, brain structure was relatively immutable. But new findings reveal that many aspects of the brain and nervous system can change structurally and functionally, including learning, memory, and recovery from brain damage throughout adulthood. But the opposite is also true. Nerve cells that no longer fire together no longer wire together. If you don't use it, you lose it. You can even focus conscious thought to disconnect or unwire unwanted connections. Thus, it is possible to let go of some of the stuff you've been holding on to that colors the way you think, act, and feel. The rewired brain will no longer fire according to the circuitry of the past. The gift of neuroplasticity, the brain's ability to rewire and create new circuits at any age as a result of input from the environment or our conscious intentions, is that we can create a new level of mind. There's a sort of neurological, out with the old, in with the new, a process that neuroscientists call pruning and sprouting. It's what I call unlearning and learning, and it creates the opportunity for us to rise above our current limitations and to be greater than our conditioning or circumstances. In creating a new habit of being ourselves, we are essentially taking conscious control over what has become an unconscious process of being. Instead of the mind working toward one goal, I'm not going to be an angry person, and the body working toward another, let's stay angry and keep bathing in those familiar chemicals. We want to unify the mind's intent with the body's responses. To do this, we must create a new way of thinking, doing, and being. Given that to change our lives, we first have to change our thoughts and feelings, then do something, change our actions or behaviors, to have a new experience, which in turn produces a new feeling, and then we must memorize that feeling until we move into a state of being, when mind and body are one. At least we've got a few things going for us. Along with the brain being neuroplastic, we could say that we have more than one brain to work with. In effect, we have three of them. For our purposes, this chapter will limit its focus to those functions of the three brains that relate specifically to breaking the habit of being ourselves. On a personal note, I find studying what the brain and other components of the nervous system do for us is an endlessly fascinating exploration. My first book, Evolve Your Brain, covered this topic in more detail than would serve our purposes here. There are additional resources for study on my website, www.drjoedispenza.com, and of course, many other excellent publications and websites are available for those who want to learn more about the brain, the mind, and the body. Refer Figure 6A, The Three Brains. Our thinking brain is the neocortex, the brain's walnut-like outer covering. Humanity's newest, most advanced neurological hardware, the neocortex, is the seat of the conscious mind, our identity, and other higher brain functions. The frontal lobe, discussed in earlier chapters, is one of four parts of the neocortex. Essentially, the neocortex is the brain's architect or designer. It allows you to learn, remember, reason, analyze, plan, create, speculate on possibilities, invent, and communicate. Since this area is where you log sensory data, such as what you see and hear, the neocortex plugs you into external reality. In general, the neocortex processes knowledge and experience. First, you gather knowledge in the form of facts or semantic information, philosophical or theoretical concepts or ideas that you learn intellectually, prompting the neocortex to add new synaptic connections and circuits. Second, once you decide to personalize or apply knowledge you have acquired to demonstrate what you learned, you will invariably create a new experience. This causes patterns of neurons called neural networks to form in the neocortex. These networks reinforce the circuitry of what you learned intellectually. If the neocortex had a motto, it might be, "Knowledge is for the mind." Simply put, knowledge is the precursor to experience. Your neocortex is responsible for processing ideas that you have not yet experienced, which exist as a potential for you to embrace at some future time. As you entertain new thoughts, you begin to think about modifying your behavior so that you can do something differently when the opportunity presents itself, in order to have a new outcome. As you then alter your routine actions and typical behaviors, something different from the norm should happen, which will produce a new event for you to experience. The limbic brain, also known as the mammalian brain, located under the neocortex, is the most highly developed and specialized area of the brain in mammals other than humans, dolphins, and higher primates. Just think of the limbic brain as the chemical brain or the emotional brain. When you're in the midst of that new experience and your senses send a rush of corresponding information from your external world to your neocortex, its neural networks organize themselves to reflect the event. Thus, experience enriches the brain even further than new knowledge. The moment those networks of neurons fire with a pattern specific to that new experience, the emotional brain manufactures and releases chemicals in the form of peptides. This chemical cocktail has a specific signature that reflects the emotions you are experiencing in the moment. As you now know, emotions are the end products of experience. A new experience creates a new emotion, which signals new genes in new ways. Thus, emotions signal the body to record the event chemically, and you begin to embody what you are learning. In the process, the limbic brain assists in forming long-term memories. You can remember any experience better because you can recall how you felt emotionally while the event was occurring. The neocortex and limbic brain together enable us to form declarative memories, meaning that we can declare what we've learned or experienced. See figure 6B1 for more information on declarative and non-declarative memories. You can see then how we are marked emotionally by highly charged experiences. All people who have been married can tell you where they were and what they were doing when they or their beloved proposed. Perhaps they were eating a great meal on the patio of their favorite restaurant, feeling the balmy breezes of that summer night and enjoying the sunset while the strains of Mozart played softly in the background, when their dinner partner got down on one knee and held out that little black box. The combination of everything that they were experiencing in that moment made them feel very different from their normal self. The typical internal chemical balance that their identity self had memorized got knocked out of order by what they saw, heard, and felt. In a sense, they woke up from the familiar, routine environmental stimuli that typically bombard the brain and cause us to think and feel in predictable ways. Novel events surprise us to the point that we become more aware in the present moment. If the limbic brain had a motto, it might be, "Experience is for the body." If knowledge is for the mind and experience is for the body, then when you apply knowledge and create a new experience, you teach the body what the mind has intellectually learned. Knowledge without experience is merely philosophy. Experience without knowledge is ignorance. There's a progression that has to take place. You have to take knowledge and live it. Embrace it emotionally. If you're still with me as I've been discussing how to change your life, then you've learnt about gaining knowledge and then taking action to have a new experience, which produces a new feeling. Next, you have to memorize that feeling and move what you've learned from the conscious mind to the subconscious mind. You've already got the hardware to do that in the third brain area we'll discuss. Do you remember my talking about the common experience when we can't consciously remember a phone number, ATM pin, or lock combination, but we've practiced it so often that the body knows better than the brain, and our fingers automatically get the job done? That may seem like a small thing, but when the body knows equal to or better than the conscious mind, when you can repeat an experience at will without much conscious effort, then you have memorized the action, behavior, attitude, or emotional reaction until it has become a skill or a habit. When you reach this level of ability, you have moved into a state of being. In the process, you've activated the third brain area that plays a major role in changing your life, the cerebellum, seat of the subconscious. The most active part of the brain, the cerebellum, is located at the back of the skull. Think of it as the brain's microprocessor and memory center. Every neuron in the cerebellum has the potential to connect with at least 200,000 and up to 1 million other cells to process balance, coordination, awareness of the spatial relation of body parts, and execution of controlled movements. The cerebellum stores certain types of simple actions and skills, along with hardwired attitudes, emotional reactions, repeated actions, habits, conditioned behaviors, and unconscious reflexes and skills that we have mastered and memorized. Processing amazing memory storage, it easily downloads various forms of learned information into programmed states of mind and body. When you are in a state of being, you begin to memorize a new neurochemical self. That's when the cerebellum takes over making that new state an implicit part of your subconscious programming. The cerebellum is the site of non-declarative memories, meaning that you've done or practiced something so many times that it's become second nature and you don't have to think about it. It's become so automatic that it's hard to declare or describe how you do it. When that happens, you will arrive at a point when happiness, or whatever attitude, behavior, skill, or trait you've been focusing on and rehearsing mentally or physically, will become an innately memorized program of the new self. Let's use a true-to-life example to take a practical look at how these three brains take us from thinking to doing to being. First, we'll see how through conscious mental rehearsal, the thinking brain, neocortex, uses knowledge to activate new circuits in new ways to make a new mind. Then, our thought creates an experience, and via the emotional, limbic brain, that produces a new emotion. Our thinking and feeling brains condition the body to a new mind. Finally, if we reach the point where mind and body are working as one, the cerebellum enables us to memorize a new neurochemical self, and our new state of being is now an innate program in our subconscious. As a practical look into these ideas, suppose that you recently read a few thought-provoking books about compassion, including one written by the Dalai Lama, a biography of Mother Teresa, and an account of the work of St. Francis of Assisi. This knowledge allowed you to think outside the box. Reading this material would have forged new synaptic connections in your thinking brain. Essentially, you learned about the philosophy of compassion through other people's experiences, not yours. Moreover, you've sustained those neural connections by reviewing what you learned on a daily basis. You're so enthusiastic that you are solving all of your friends' problems by offering advice and holding court. You have become the great philosopher. Intellectually, you know your stuff. As you're driving home from work, your spouse calls to say that you've been invited to dinner with your mother-in-law in 3 days. You pull off the road, and already you're thinking about how you have disliked your mother-in-law intensely ever since she hurt your feelings 10 years ago. Soon you've got a mental laundry list. You never liked her opinionated way of talking, how she interrupts others, how she smells, even how she cooks. Whenever you're around her, your heart races, your jaw tightens, and your face and body are tense. You feel jittery, and you just want to jump up and leave. Still sitting in your car, you remember those books on the philosophy of compassion, and you think about what you learned theoretically. It occurs to you, maybe if I try to apply what I read in those books, I might have a new experience of my mother-in-law. What did I learn that I can personalize to change the outcome of this dinner? When you contemplate applying that understanding with your mother-in-law, something wonderful begins to happen. You decide not to react to her with your typical set of automatic programs. Instead, you begin to think about who you no longer want to be, and who you want to be instead. You ask yourself, how do I not want to feel, and how am I not going to act when I see her? Your frontal lobe begins to cool off the neural circuits that are connected to the old you. You're starting to unwire or prune away that old you from functioning as an identity. You could say that because your brain isn't firing in the same way, you're no longer creating the same mind. Then you review what those books said to help you plan how you want to think, feel, and act towards your mother-in-law. You ask yourself, how can I modify my behavior, my actions, and my reaction so my new experience leads to a new feeling? So, you picture yourself greeting and hugging her, asking her questions about things you know she's interested in, complimenting her on her new hairdo or glasses.